Chapter 3. In, now I have taken the trouble to bring the book. All right, I'll overtake you and Cuthbert in 5 minutes. Don't stop. I give my word that I will, Felix. The two elder reluctantly left him and walked on, taking their brother's knapsack to relieve him in following, and the youngest entered the field. This is a thousand pities, he said gallantly, to two or three of the girls nearest him, as soon as there was a pause in the dance. W, where are your partners, my dears? They've not left off work yet, answered one of the boldest. T, they'll be here by and by. Till then, will you be one, sir? Certainly. But what's one among so many? Better than none. 'Tis melancholy work facing and footing it to one of your own sort, and no clipsing and coaling at all. Now, pick and choose. SSH, don't be so forward, said a shyer girl. The young man, thus invited, clanked them over, and attempted some discrimination. But, as the group were all so new to him, he could not very well exercise it. He took almost the first that came to hand, which was not the speaker, as he had expected. Nor did it happen to be Tess Derbyfield. Pedigree, ancestral skeletons, monumental record, the D'Urberville lineaments, did not help Tess in her life's battle as yet, even to the extent of attracting to her a dancing partner over the heads of the commonest peasantry. So much for Norman blood unaided by Victorian lucre. The name of the eclipsing girl, whatever it was, has not been handed down, but she was envied by all as the first who enjoyed the luxury of a masculine partner that evening. Yet such was the force of example that the village young men, who had not hastened to enter the gate, while no intruder was in the way, now dropped in quickly, and soon the couples became leavened with rustic youth to a marked extent, till at length the plainest woman in the club was no longer compelled to foot it on the masculine side of the figure. The church clock struck, when suddenly the student said that he must leave. He had been forgetting himself, he had to join his companions. As he fell out of the dance, his eyes lighted on Tess Derbyfield, whose own large orbs wore, to tell the truth, the faintest aspect of reproach, that he had not chosen her. He, too, was sorry then that, owing to her backwardness, he had not observed her, and with that in his mind he left the pasture. On account of his long delay he started in a flying run down the lane westward, and had soon passed the hollow, and mounted the next rise. He had not yet overtaken his brothers, but he paused to get breath, and looked back. He could see the white figures of the girls, in the green enclosure whirling about as they had whirled, when he was among them. They seemed to have quite forgotten him already. All of them, except, perhaps, one. This white shape stood apart by the hedge alone. From her position he knew it to be the pretty maiden with whom he had not danced. Trifling as the matter was, he yet instinctively felt that she was hurt by his oversight. He wished that he had asked her. He wished that he had inquired her name. She was so modest, so expressive, as he had looked, so soft in her thin white gown, that he felt he had acted stupidly. However, it could not be helped, and turning, and bending himself to a rapid walk, he dismissed the subject from his mind. 3. As for Tess Derbyfield, she did not so easily dislodge the incident from her consideration. As he had no spirit to dance again for a long time, though she might have had plenty of partners. But they did not speak so nicely as the strange young man had done. It was not till the rays of the sun had absorbed the young stranger's retreating figure on the hill that she shook off her temporary sadness and answered her would-be partner in the affirmative. She remained with her comrades till dusk and participated with a certain zest in the dancing, though, being heart whole as yet, she enjoyed treading a measure purely for its own sake, little divining when she saw the soft torments, the bitter sweets, the pleasing pains, and the agreeable distresses of those girls who had been wooed and won, what she herself was capable of in that kind. The struggles and wrangles of the lads for her hand in a jig were an amusement to her no more, and when they became fierce she rebuked them. She might have stayed even later, but the incident of her father's odd appearance and manner returned upon the girl's mind to make her anxious, and wondering what had become of him, she dropped away from the dancers, and bent her steps towards the end of the village at which the parental cottage lay. While yet many score yards off, other rhythmic sounds than those she had quitted became audible to her, sounds that she knew well so well. They were a regular series of thumpings from the interior of the house, occasioned by the violent rocking of a cradle upon a stone floor, to which movement a feminine voice kept time by singing, in a vigorous gallopade, the favorite ditty of the spotted cow, "I saw her lie down in yonder green grove. Come, love. ... and I'll tell you where." ... the cradle rocking, and the song would cease simultaneously for a moment, and an explanation at highest vocal pitch would take the place of the melody. "God bless thy diamond eyes, and thy waxen cheeks, and thy cherry mouth, and thy cupid's thighs, and every bit o' thy blessed body." After this invocation the rocking and the singing would recommence, and the potted cow proceed as before. So matters stood when Tess opened the door, and paused upon the mat within it surveying the scene. The interior, in spite of the melody, struck upon the girl's senses with an unspeakable dreariness. From the holiday gaieties of the field the white gowns, the nosegays, the willow wands, the whirling movements on the green, the flash of gentle sentiment towards the stranger to the yellow melancholy of this one-candled spectacle, what a step! Besides the jar of contrast there came to her a chill self-reproach that she had not returned sooner, to help her mother in these domesticities, instead of indulging herself out of doors. There stood her mother amid the group of children, as Tess had left her, hanging over the Monday washing tub, which had now, as always, lingered on to the end of the week. Out of that tub had come the day before Tess felt it with a dreadful sting of remorse the very white frock upon her back which she had so carelessly greened about the skirt on the damping grass which had been rung up, and ironed by her mother's own hands. As usual, Mrs. Durbeyfield was balanced on one foot beside the tub, the other being engaged in the aforesaid business of rocking her youngest child. The cradle rockers had done hard duty for so many years, under the weight of so many children, on that flagstone floor, that they were worn nearly flat, in consequence of which a huge jerk accompanied each swing of the cot, flinging the baby from side to side like a weaver's shuttle, as Mrs. Durbeyfield, excited by her song, trod the rocker with all the spring that was left in her after a long day's seething in the suds. Knick-knock, knick-knock, went the cradle, the candle flame stretched itself tall, and began jigging up and down, the water dribbled from the matron's elbows, and the song galloped on to the end of the verse, Mrs. Durbeyfield regarding her daughter the while. Even now, when burdened with a young family, Joan Durbeyfield was a passionate lover of tune. No ditty floated into Blackmoor Vale from the outer world, but Tess's mother caught up its notation in a week. There still faintly beamed from the woman's features something of the freshness, and even the prettiness, of her youth, rendering it probable that the personal charms which Tess could boast of were in main part her mother's gift, and therefore unknightly, unhistorical. "I'll rock the cradle for 'ee, mother," said the daughter gently. "Or I'll take off my best frock, and help you ring up. I thought you had finished long ago." Her mother bore Tess no ill will for leaving the housework to her single-handed efforts for so long. Indeed, Joan seldom upbraided her thereon at any time, feeling but slightly the lack of Tess's assistance, whilst her instinctive plan for relieving herself of her labors lay in postponing them. Tonight, however, she was even in a blither mood than usual. There was a dreaminess, a preoccupation, an exultation, in the maternal look which the girl could not understand. "Well, I'm glad you've come," her mother said, as soon as the last note had passed out of her. "I want to go and fetch your father, but what's more'n that, I want to tell ye what have happened. It'll be fess enough, my poppet, when th'st know." Mrs. Durbeyfield habitually spoke the dialect, Her daughter, who had passed the sixth standard in the national school under a London-trained mistress, spoke two languages. The dialect at home, more or less, ordinary English abroad, and two persons of quality.
Since I've been away? Tess asked. A. Had it anything to do with father's making such a mammoth of himself in thick carriage this afternoon? Why did her? I felt inclined to sink into the ground with shame. That we're all a part of the Larry. We've been found to be the greatest gentlefolk in the whole county, reaching all back long before Oliver Grumble's time to the days of the pagan Turks with monuments, and vaults, and crests, and cutcheons, and the Lord knows what all. In St. Charles's days we was made knights o' the Royal Oak, our real name being D'Urberville. Dot dot dot, don't that make your bosom plim? 'Twas on this account that your father rode home in the vlee, not because he'd been drinking, as people supposed. I'm glad of that. Will it do us any good, mother? Oh yes. 'Tis thoughted that great things may come out. No doubt a mampus of folk of our own rank will be down here in their carriages, as soon as 'tis known. Your father learned it on his way home from Shaston, and he has been telling me the whole pedigree of the matter. Where is father now? Asked Tess suddenly. Her mother gave irrelevant information by way of answer: colon he called to see the doctor today in Shaston. It is not consumption at all, it seems. It is fat round his heart, says. There, it is like this. Joan Derbyfield, as she spoke, curved a sodden thumb and forefinger to the shape of the letter C, and used the other forefinger as a pointer. At the present moment, apostrophe, he says to your father, your heart is enclosed all round there, and all round there, this space is still open, apostrophe, says. As soon as it do meet, so, Mrs. Derbyfield closed her fingers into a circle complete off, you will go like a shatter, Mr. Derbyfield, apostrophe, says. You mid last 10 years, you mid go off in 10 months, or 10 days. Apostrophe, Tess looked alarmed. Her father possibly to go behind the eternal cloud so soon, notwithstanding this sudden greatness. But where is father? She asked again. Her mother put on a deprecating look. How don't you be bursting out angry? The poor man, he felt so rafted after his uplifting by the passon's news, that he went up to her Oliver's half an hour ago. He do want to get up his strength for his journey tomorrow with that load of beehives, which must be delivered, family or no. He'll have to start shortly after 12 tonight, as the distance is so long. Get up his strength, said Tess impetuously, the tears welling to her eyes. My God! Go to a public house, to get up his strength. And you as well agreed as he, mother. Her rebuke and her mood seemed to fill the whole room, and to impart a cowed look to the furniture, and candle, and children playing about, and to her mother's face. No, said the latter touchily, I be not agreed. I have been waiting for ye to bide, and keep house, while I go fetch him. I'll go. Oh no, Tess. You see, it would be no use. Tess did not expostulate. She knew what her mother's objection meant. Mrs. Derbyfield's jacket and bonnet were already hanging slyly upon a chair by her side, in readiness for this contemplated jaunt, the reason for which the matron deplored more than its necessity. And take the complete fortune teller to the outhouse. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.